Hey guys, it's Jordana, and welcome back to a very exciting episode of the Mindful Method podcast. I am so excited to talk about this topic with you guys because, truthfully, this has been a work in progress for the past 4 years. And finally, at the end of spring in 2023, I completed this research. And since then, it actually has had such a profound impact on not just my practice, but kind of as a pioneer in the field. So just like right off the bat, the topic is the efficacy of psychedelics and how they can affect overeating behaviors. So I have talked on a podcast before about using psychedelics and how they impact the brain. I didn't really go into detail with my own research because I hadn't completed it yet. So now that the research is done, I'm so excited to share this with you guys. And truthfully, this research has been such a breeding ground for so many other collaborations and, you know, like next steps within the field. So one thing that is very exciting that's happening and it's coming in 2024 is we have collaborated with a microdosing company in the States, and we are creating the Mindful Clinic's very first product. And this product is going to be a supplement. I'm not going to tell you too much about it, but what I will say is that it's going to blow the whole industry up because this will be the very first of its kind that's really geared towards my specific clientele. So really people who are dealing with behaviors of overconsumption around food. So any type of eating psychopathology in the form of overconsumption. So we're talking emotional eating, binge eating, whatever you want to call it, stress eating, food addiction, whatever your term is for it. We are creating the first product that's actually addressing that issue. So stay tuned, get excited. It's coming very soon. It's already developed. We're just working with labeling and shipping and all that stuff. So now, not only has this created a lot of collaborations, but this research specifically has been a motivating factor for me to develop a retreat. And so at the end of May, beginning of June, the Mindful Clinic is hosting its first ever all-inclusive macrodose plant medicine psychedelic retreat. And I'll give you more information on that later, but I may as well just get into the research because I have been talking it up so much. But this is a really big one because this topic is literally blowing up right now, not just in Mindful Clinic, but also in research and data. Like, obviously, the efficacy of psychedelics has really been brought to the forefront in the past couple of years. And a lot of this is because, you know, I will go into the history of psychedelics a little bit, but when psychedelics were first established in the late 1930s, early 1940s, there were a few decades where they were used and researched and they were able to be used for a clinical perspective and for a therapeutic perspective. And then they were basically just made a Schedule I substance. So that actually prevented so many clinical trials. And then now kind of coming out of that, where I know in some places it's a very big gray area. This is why we're doing the retreat in California and Joshua Tree, because it is like somewhat legal there. It's not legal to like deal it, but you can still engage in using it. But I'm in Canada, right? And so here it's still quite illegal. And with my research, I was very limited in what I was actually able to quantify and call effective because I couldn't use quantitative data. So the difference between quantitative data and qualitative data when you're writing your thesis is quantitative data is really cause and effect stuff. So this is stuff that we can quantify. These are percentages, percentages of populations. These are things where we are creating graphs, etc. Qualitative data is really kind of firsthand accounts. And qualitative data sometimes outdoes quantitative data in the sense where we just get a much deeper understanding of what we're studying. However, qualitative data is, of course, very subjective because we are using things like interviews in order and people's firsthand accounts in order to gather research and gather data and then code all of it and put it into categories. And so hopefully at this point, if you're still with me, you're kind of catching the understanding of what big of a task this was. Like, my thesis was well over 200 pages and it was so, so much work, but it was so unbelievably rewarding. And I'm so grateful that I did it on this. So anyways, without any further ado, let's fucking dive in.
Welcome to the Head to Heal podcast, where you'll go head over heels learning about how the body and the brain work together to either feed disease or fight it. I'm your host, Jordana Sade, certified holistic nutritionist and founder of the Mindful Clinic. With a background in nutrition, behavioral neuropsychology, and hypnosis, I'm going to walk you through the root cause of your symptoms and disordered behaviors. The body has an innate ability to heal. No one is destined for illness, and most, if not all, disorders can be reversed. Come with me as we develop a new understanding of how you can use your head to heal and truly thrive.
So my research was on the efficacy of psychedelic therapy for eating psychopathology in the form of overconsumption. That's a mouthful. I totally understand. But basically what I'm studying here is how effective are psychedelics for overeating behaviors. And the really cool thing about doing this research is there is so much literature, like truly so much literature and so much research that prove the efficacy of psychedelics for other overconsumption behaviors, for substance abuse, for alcoholism, for addictions, for treatment-resistant disorders in general. But there are very few, and actually my research was one of the very first for overconsumption of food behaviors. Again, we are right at the forefront. So there's a lot of research that's coming out right now on eating disorders in general, a lot on anorexia and bulimia, but binge eating, emotional eating, food addiction, this is a very new territory. And I'm so grateful to have been kind of pioneering this. All right, so first of all, in order to establish that this is even a viable hypothesis, okay, I had to first do a deep dive into the current literature of the efficacy of psychedelics in general. Like, what were psychedelics being used for, and where do they perform well, and where are the gaps in research, and how can we kind of create a thesis based on that? So essentially what happened, and I'm going to get into a little bit of the history because it's just truly so fascinating. In 1938, Dr. Albert Hofmann was doing research on a type of fungal molecular constituent that he found that we later labeled as LSD. Now, that active constituent, he was researching it. He knew it had somewhat psychoactive effects, but he didn't know exactly what was going to happen. And a lot of Dr. Albert Hofmann's research was in alcoholism and how do we actually change these very treatment-resistant disorders where people get really stuck in these compulsive behaviors that have large consequences. And, you know, the average person does want to stop despite knowing the consequences. The cool thing about addiction is that the brain genuinely thinks that the substance is required for safety. So the way, there's like different phases of addiction. I've done a podcast on this, but the way that it works is when somebody gets addicted to a substance, when the brain is void of the substance, it actually thinks it's like dying. And so it is going to motivate you and it's going to send cues for you to engage in behaviors to gain access to that substance despite knowing the consequences. This is when prefrontal cortex turns off. Like, we have no impulse control. And so amygdala's firing, stress response is firing. It's like, ah, we're in danger. Prefrontal cortex turns off, no impulse control. And there you are going to get access to the substance, even though you promised this was the last time ever. And so when we look at the research and the history of psychedelics, Dr. Albert Hofmann, 1938, found this active constituent. And he took it. He just experimented on himself. He took 250 milligrams of LSD. And the way that he describes his experience is just so beautiful. I'll link up some of the original research studies in the show notes of this. But he's describing this experience as if, you know, he took the substance and then on his way home, he was biking home and the street started to cave into him. You know, like everything started to twist and turn and he actually thought he was in a nightmare. His neighbor came out and she turned into a witch and he was like terrified. He had no idea what was going on. But the cool thing is he woke up the next day and when he woke up, he opened his door and he went outside and the sun was brighter. The birds were chirping louder. He felt this deep sense of profound connection to himself. And it's almost this sense of a new beginning. And it truly changed his life. And so when we talk about the psychedelic experience, I sure shit cannot guarantee that you're not going to have a bad trip, especially if you're doing it in a macro dose. I've never had fully a bad trip. Like there was one time when things got wonky close to the end, but you know, I know a lot of interventions and stuff to get myself out of it. And I will be helping people on the retreat, like facilitate helping to get them out of it as well. But I can't guarantee you're going to have a good trip, because what psychedelics do sometimes is they almost like go into the dark and twisty places in your brain where all the cobwebs are, and they just kind of clean out the cobwebs, right? And so in order to do that, sometimes we have to see the shadow side. But the repercussions of that is that we wake up the next day and the brain has changed completely. It's kind of like worked through all the kinks in the chain. And then you wake up and you no longer have this like habitual program that relates to self-sabotage, because you have this newfound sense of self. And ultimately, when we talk about something like addiction, addiction is really losing yourself and disconnecting from your true self. And that's why we call it recovery, right? We're recovering ourselves. That's actually a quote by Dr. Gabor Mate. I can't take credit for that one. So in the history of psychedelics, like there's so many different research studies, but I'll just reference a few of them. One of them that was done by Spriggs and colleagues, and this was in 2020. And he really describes this ultimate experience where it offers this one-time solution to deal with treatment-resistant disorders. Now, treatment-resistant disorders are basically all mental health disorders, okay? Because mental health disorders like are so unbelievably complex because they change from person to person. Like you can have depression because your parent died and you never kind of came out of it, or you can be depressed because of an environmental toxin that's changing your brain chemistry. So we can't just give an SSRI to everybody. SSRI is a selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor. We can't just give that to everybody and expect that everybody's going to have the same reaction, right? So it's really important to understand that I'm not denoting things like depression medication and anxiety medication, but I am trying to say that most of the people who have these disorders are still dealing with depression and anxiety. And the truth of the matter is these mental health conditions and these mental health solutions that we have, these these psychopharmaceuticals that we use for these mental health disorders are lifelong. Like you can't just come off of it. Scary, terrible things happen. I mean, you can if you do it appropriately, but it's not recommended, right? So if you deal with a mental health disorder like PTSD, depression, anxiety, just anything like that, you're looking at long-term, lifelong psychopharmaceuticals and lifelong therapy. When in contrast to that, we actually have access to a substance that genuinely changes the brain forever with a one lifetime experience. Like you can change the brain in one single experience. It's very profound. And so Dr. Albert Hofmann knew he was onto something really good. And so they started to do all these clinical studies, and essentially psychedelics were used specifically for people that struggle with addiction, and alcoholism was really where a lot of the research is. And then in the 1970s, clinical studies came to a halt when LSD was banned and classified as a Schedule I substance with criminal implications. So basically saying like there's criminal implications, there's no medical benefits, and there's high risk for abuse. Like that's what classifies a Schedule I substance. When in reality, like now that we're kind of like going back to the clinical trials and we're reviewing these substances that we've kept away, or we've kept in a box, we've locked up in jail, if you will, for so many years, we're really seeing that actually there's a very low risk for abuse, almost no risk for abuse. Most psychedelics are non-dependent completely, and they're very therapeutic. In the same way we're taking something like lion's mane is going to be beneficial for the brain, psychedelics like psilocybin, like LSD, like these come from the same family. They're fungal. And so it does have very profound therapeutic implications for the nervous system with very, very low risk of health, with a very low health risk. It's not going to affect things like obesity. And in fact, it has a very positive outcome on obesity. But, you know, some of these things like SSRIs and anti-anxiolytics, you look down the road and people end up with a lot of weight gain, they end up with high cholesterol, they end up with high blood pressure. And so there's just a lot of side effects that come with the general psychopharmaceuticals that are not even relevant with things like psychedelics. So what these do is they offer a unique one-time experience that really has the potential to facilitate these like very deep emotional breakthroughs and lead to positive behavioral outcomes. So I'm going to be very clear here and say that, okay, the first time I did LSD, I was in high school. And I remember doing LSD with my friends. And the first time I did it, it wasn't a very strong dose. So it just kind of felt like I was on shrooms, where it almost felt like I was in a comic book or something, you know, like everything was sketched, not sketchy, but like it looked like the trees were sketched on. And I felt more connected to the friend group that I was in. And I stayed up a lot later. But the next time that we did LSD, it was a very, very strong batch. And actually, one of my friends, when we were on it, had a really, really bad trip. And I wish I knew now what I wish I knew then what I knew now, because I would have approached it completely differently. But it was insane. Like, I remember being on the streetcar and just having, not being able to really see things. Like, colors are just swarming into one another. And then we were in the forest and we were having so much fun. And one of my close friends at the time, who, when we did these types of drugs, we always kind of came together. It was like our energies just kind of aligned. We stayed in our friend's kitchen and just laughed for hours, just like really dissecting the human experience. It's such a unique thing. I can't really describe it, but it's like you take this substance and you just learn about yourself. You are able to go into different parts of your brain that you genuinely cannot access in like regular consciousness. And you start to put the puzzle pieces together and start to understand who you are and what the meaning of life is for you and what your purpose is. And it's all very, very, very profound. Okay. It's an incredible experience. And as a child, when I was taking these substances, I was also addicted to weed. I was also addicted to cigarettes, and I eventually became an alcoholic. And when I did LSD, it's not like I woke up the next morning and I was like, I don't want to smoke, right? Like, I don't want to do cocaine. So what I'm trying to say here is, if you're using these substances without intention, you're not going to have the same profound life-changing, brain-changing experience as if you're doing it with somebody who is licensed to facilitate it in a specific way that actually allows the brain to change. And a lot of that comes down to like the intention that you're putting on it. There's a big research study by Imperiority and colleagues, and this was done in 2016. And they were talking about how the intention of using the psychedelic drug actually is more effective than the psychedelic drug itself. Because if you went into it with the idea of, I want to quit smoking, you were so much more likely, and I think it was like 50% of people were not able to quit smoking without an intention. But when you did have an intention, 90% of those people were able to quit smoking for up to an entire year. And so that to me tells me that the intention does matter. There is, like, based on this research, there's a 50% chance that if you don't put an intention on it, there's still going to be benefits, right? But if you do go into it with a specific intention, you're just so much more likely to be able to access the parts of your brain that need to be accessed in order for you to come out the other side so that you can experience the thing you want to experience, okay? So another study by Spriggs and colleagues, and this is in 2020. I think I referenced this one already, but they basically describe psychedelics as being a class of drugs that affect the serotonin 2A receptor. So the reason why this is so unbelievably important for eating psychopathology is because the serotonin 2A receptor is the specific receptor that deals with satiety. So when we activate the serotonin 2A receptor, we feel satiated. And remember, there's a very big difference between serotonin and dopamine, right? Dopamine is the molecule of more. Dopamine is like the molecule of motivation. When we release dopamine, we want more and more and more. Serotonin is the opposite. Serotonin is satiation. It's like this, we can take a step back. We feel full. We feel complete. We feel fulfilled. It's staying still versus moving forward. And we need a good balance of both. And so when we're working with these substances that activate dopamine in such a profound way, like cocaine, like most food is designed, you know, like these foods are so highly palatable. They really do create activate dopaminergic pathways, right? And so when we activate those dopaminergic pathways in such a common way during the day, we need to be addressing the serotonin 2A receptor to deal with that. So the serotonin 2A receptor is very important for overeating behaviors because when we have an imbalance in dopamine, so we engage in behaviors to feel pleasure, we engage in eating to get a hit of something or because it tastes good or because it's crunchy and we go from salty to sweet and back to salty, that tells me that that client specifically has an imbalance in dopamine. But if we activate the serotonin 2A receptor, all of a sudden we feel satiated. And so when I came across this research, it really showed me that I was on the right path. Not only did I have a hypothesis based off of my own experience, which I won't get into for time purposes today, but a huge part of me healing my relationship to food on top of actually going back to school, learning about psychology was I was really experimenting with psilocybin at this time. And I just noticed that when I was microdosing, I was so much more in tune with myself and my hunger cues that it made it very easy to not stress eat. There's also the component where, you know, when we're using psychedelics, a major thing, and in my research, this was a huge topic, but it does reduce a lot of anxiety and stress. And so if you're somebody who's a stress eater, then taking something like a psychedelic would really like lower that desire to need to self-soothe because we're not so anxious all the time. I really should have said this in the beginning, but I just need to give a big, big, big disclaimer that in no way am I'm not a doctor, I'm not a medical doctor, and I am not diagnosing, I am not recommending that you take anything, especially without a practitioner's go ahead. So please, please, please work with somebody who's trained, especially because there's a huge group of people that should not be engaging in psychedelic therapy. And I will come back to that at the end, but there's a lot of people that we have to turn down for the retreat because they're not a viable candidate. And so so just please don't go into it blindly. Okay. So now that we understand the history and now that we have this like little kind of love crumb from the universe that showed us, oh, no pun intended, a crumb, love crumb from the universe that shows us that, okay, if we're working on the serotonin 2A receptor, then the likelihood of people feeling satiated when they're taking these mushrooms or whatever LSD is that they're going to, it's going to reduce appetite, but bottom line. We have to then understand why people overeat. So very, very, very similarly, and when I was reading the literature, it was just unbelievably profound how many research studies there truly were that prove the link between early life adversity. So this is like trauma, we call it ELA, but early life adversity and overeating. And these are the same studies that are also linking overeating and substance abuse. So the research is fucking there. It's there. We know that obesity is not an issue of not like knowing what to eat. We know that obesity comes from the desire to overconsume despite knowing the negative consequences. And so if that's the case, then there is an imbalance in the brain. And we have to understand how that imbalance fucking got there. We don't just fucking take Ozempic. Saxenda is the old brand name, but we don't just take Ozempic, which reduces our appetite, and call it a day. We have to deal with the root cause. So when we look at the inferiority study, the one done with colleagues in 2016, they are the ones who are studying the prevalence of early life adversity, so childhood trauma and food overconsumption. And this is a 2016 study. Like this is almost 10 years old. So like the research is there, okay? So what they're doing is they're looking at early life adversity and they're saying like, okay, what does childhood trauma actually do to the brain? Well, childhood trauma adversely affects both the brain development, so how the brain is actually building out pathways and developing, but also several mental functions that interfere with the maturity of executive control and social cognition networks. So executive control and social cognition networks basically establish the individual's ability to think and regulate their sense of self. This is an individual's ability to regulate motivation and behaviors. And so childhood trauma is actually associated with things like illicit drug use, obesity, impulse control, and all of those disorders later in life. And this is confirmed in 2020 by Wyss and colleagues. So like all of these studies are kind of building up on one another where we're looking at the root cause of overeating behaviors. And we're saying things like childhood trauma, which is something we've been doing in my practice since we've opened, right? Like childhood trauma changes the way the brain functions and prevents that individual from being able to make conscious decisions that relate to things like motivation, self-regulation, impulse control, etc. So when we have these traumatic childhood experiences, and it doesn't need to be this huge thing, right? Like for me, it was a kid calling me fat that I had a crush on, but it was also having highly critical parents coming home every day and my parents saying like, where's the other 2% when I didn't get 100% on something? Or it was my mom saying, stop crying, you're embarrassing me. Or it was my dad saying, like me trying to desperately please my parents and pushing down my own needs. Like that is also trauma. That does also impact the nervous system. And so this early life adversity and the childhood trauma is going to affect the way the endorphin system builds out. And the endorphin system deals with our regulation of things like pleasure, satiety, motivation. And so when we have these childhood experiences, the brain is going to be seeking pleasure more so than somebody who didn't have these childhood experiences or had them and was taught to emotionally regulate without needing a substance. And this is like one of the biggest root causes of how people develop overeating behaviors, especially because when we're going through this, we're children and food is the number one substance that's available at that time. Yeah. So there's so much else that I can say about this, but we will be here for hours. But eating psychopathology in the form of overconsumption is just very relevant right now. And honestly, it has potentially fatal consequences. Like binge eating disorder is the most common overeating disorder, and it affects like 28 million people. And the long-term effects of overconsumption don't just result around physiological implications like, you know, things that relate to obesity. So, you know, heart disease, atherosclerosis, diabetes, etc. But it's also like from a personal growth and emotional perspective, like it's very comorbid with depression, anxiety, low self-worth, and low confidence. And so the efficacy in psychedelics and their ability to manipulate the neurotransmitters and change the way the brain performs is profound. Like nothing else does this. And that's why I'm so obsessed with using psychedelics. And that's also why we've built out this retreat so that we can do it in a safe place and we can facilitate. We can make sure that we are putting the things into place that are going to help people actually have this very transformative and profound experience. I probably don't even need to go into the relationship between overeating and addiction, although I've done a ton of research in this too, where basically this was a research study done by Shag and colleagues. And I believe this was in 2017. I can find it after. But they describe food overconsumption as the impulsivity towards consuming food, right? So we're impulsively consuming food categorized by a heightened sensitivity in the near reward center. So when we're consuming these foods, it's like in a very impulsive way, and we're rewarded by it feeling really good in the nervous system. And this is a very spontaneous and rash behavior despite the consequences. Yes, the study was done in 2013. So when we have food overconsumption, the reward sensitivity centers are a driver for an individual to obtain rewarding stimuli. And this is the exact same thing that happens when we engage in substances. We already know that like food is very addictive. You can look at that study by Dr. Nicole Levina, where she proved that rats were more addicted to sugar than they were to cocaine. And part of that is that, you know, all beings require food to survive. And so we can be abstinent from cocaine for our entire lives and still survive and live, quite frankly, a very stable and happy life, but we can't just be abstinent from food. And so we have pathways that are in the brain that are built out to literally bypass any type of like conscious control, any desires to be thin, etc., and gain access to food because it's so, so deeply related to our survival. So eating impulsivity, as most individuals who struggle with food overconsumption and obesity feel that they are out of control, right? They feel that, you know, why can't I stop? I hear that all the time. If I could just have better discipline. And this is the categorization of addiction. It's basically engaging in a maladaptive behavior despite knowing and disliking the consequences. Hi, babes. I am so excited to talk to you about my signature program, The Mindful Method. This is the exact same method that I have been using with hundreds of successful clients to help you heal your relationship to food, to increase confidence, and to lose weight without dieting or killing yourself at the gym. If you're sick of not feeling like your best self, if you're sick of promising yourself that you'll start again on Monday,
If you're sick of going on restrictive diets only to gain back the weight, I can tell you right now that if you gained it back, it did not work. You know what's healthy and what's not. You do. You just continue to choose the unhealthy option anyways. And a meal plan will not solve this issue. There is no amount of restriction or discipline or willpower that is going to stop you from self-sabotaging. The body follows the mind. Imagine a life where you don't have to think about what you can or can't eat. Imagine a life where you feel confident in all of your clothes, where every day and every way your body rebalances and you lose all of the weight so you find the truest, healthiest version of yourself. Imagine never having to start again on Monday. This is what happens when you focus on transforming the brain so weight loss is effortless. The body follows the mind, and it's time you actually get to the root cause of your issue. If you are ready to transform and find the truest, healthiest version of you without letting go of your favorite foods, I invite you to fill out the application in my bio. And if you're a good fit, we'll be in touch soon. Back to regular programming.
Okay, if you're still with me, we're going to talk a little bit more about the different parts of the brain, like the neuroscience component. But in a study done by Volko et al. In 2013, they did neuroimaging studies and they revealed that the middle insula plays a really critical role in cravings for food, but also cocaine and cigarettes. And so it's not a coincidence that this one part of the brain deals with all of the stimulatory substances, right? Like, we're not talking about heroin here. We're not talking about oxys or opioids. That's a completely different neural pathway. But the middle insula is going to deal with the same, like, it has the same pathways built out for food, cocaine, and cigarettes. And so one really cool thing that this is just a personal hypothesis, but when you start smoking cigarettes, and I know because I started at the tender age of 13, I started to lose a lot of weight because instead of eating, I would just go outside and smoke a cigarette, and that felt very gratifying. But eventually over time, what you notice is people who smoke cigarettes initially lose a lot of weight and then they end up gaining all of it back because now when they're engaging in cigarette use over and over and over again, they overstimulate that part of the brain and then the brain starts to seek for more. Remember, this is all related to dopamine. There's a very stimulatory. And so one cigarette isn't enough, it's like, we'll have to have one cigarette and then another. And now we need food. And now we need this. It's like this constant need for validation and stimulation because without it, the brain starts to freak out and feel dysregulated. But when we have this impaired synaptic plasticity, obesity contributes to addictive-like behaviors, including a heightened motivation for highly palatable food and excessive food-seeking consumption. So when I'm talking about the middle insula and it holding space for food and overeating behaviors, I'm not just talking about broccoli. Like, I'm talking about highly palatable food and food seeking, these very specific types of foods, you know, the high, like very too salty, sweet, crunchy, like fatty, decadent. That's what I'm talking about. There's also a component here where we look at trauma, childhood trauma, and like root causes for the brain, just developing any type of nervous system disorder, depression, anxiety, et cetera, where when we have this stressor in childhood, we develop alterations in the amygdala circuitry. And especially if it happens within childhood, when the stressor was removed, the amygdala actually did not return back to baseline. Now, if you're over the age of 25 and for some beautiful reason you've never experienced any type of like very big trauma, and you do, and you don't know how to emotionally regulate, this is a lot less likely. But if you experience trauma before the age of 25 and nobody teaches your brain how to emotionally regulate, for example, I mean, you don't seek therapy immediately after, or your parents aren't emotionally regulated, like my parents are really not, so I didn't learn that. But when it happens in childhood and there's a stressor and the amygdala gets kind of denatured because of it, when they remove the stressor, the amygdala did not go back to normal, which means that throughout the rest of this person's life, the amygdala, which regulates our stress response, is going to be heightened or overactive, which means that that person's going to experience a lot more stress, anxiety, motivation to self-soothe, motivation to engage in substance-like behaviors to turn off that stressor or to feel some type of satisfaction. And then the other part of this is the ability to resist the urge to use a drug or eat past the point of satiety requires proper functioning in the neuronal networks and circuits involved with top-down control. So what I've now just kind of gone through with you is helping you guys understand that the biggest root cause to overeating behaviors is childhood trauma. This can be bullying. It can be parents died. It can be your parents having another child and you not knowing how to manage that. Like, it could literally be anything. It's just how the brain regulates around it. So we have like the precursor and then how that affects the brain. And then because of that, because it's affecting things like the amygdala and the amygdala doesn't go back to normal, then now we're not really able to engage in these like top-down functions where we have things like executive functioning, impulse control, etc. So the three last studies that I just referenced were Rinelli et al. In 2018, Wiss et al. In 2020, and Volkel et al. In 2013. And it's all kind of like synchronistic in there. Oh my gosh, there's so much that I can tell you guys. So there are many components in eating psychopathology and behavior that come into play. So we, you know, there's the impulsivity part of it, there's the emotional processing part of it, and then there's the seeking behavior, right? So impulsivity feels like you're not planning it. Like I have clients that plan binges, but impulsivity could be like you're coming home from work and you're like, I just want to stop at that one bakery and get a whole box of donuts. That's the impulsivity part. And food addiction is associated with heightened impulsivity. So this isn't just showing up in your relationship to food. Like this is showing up in like your relationship to everything. Are you impulsive with decisions? Do you jump all in and then like regret it later? Are you impulsive with your thoughts? Are you impulsive with your reactions to things? You know, do your kids really trigger you and you scream and then like later on you're like, fuck, I shouldn't have done that. Like that's how you know that there is an impulsivity component here. The other center to this is emotional processing. So this is like, are you able to actually process your emotions in a kind of a non-biased way, or do you really identify with your emotions? So do you walk around being like, oh, I didn't get that job, so I'm a failure, I'm never going to get anything? Like you kind of spiral down these spirals, you go down the spiral versus being able to process your emotions in the sense where, okay, the feeling that I'm feeling right now is sadness. I know this is I'm going to move through it. Let me hold space for this and then we'll come back, right? But stress in childhood obviously leads to using food as self-medication to alleviate these uncomfortable emotions, because in childhood we don't know how to regulate our emotions. Like that part of the brain that deals with that is genuinely not built out yet. So if your parents don't teach you, you don't learn, and then we start to look for self-soothing mechanisms. That's a study done by Hardy et al. In 2018. And then the seeking behavior. So there's a really, really cool study. This is LaFrance et al. In 2017. He's like actually looking at ayahuasca, so it's a bit of a different substance. But there's an account with an interview with a woman diagnosed with an eating disorder and engaged in ayahuasca. And she noticed a huge difference in her eating disorder symptoms. Like she said, she was very detached from her behaviors. The things that she thought that she needed, she no longer needed. And she literally said, direct quote, my brain was reprogrammed. I was able to manage emotions in a way that I couldn't prior, right? And so kind of touching on that emotional processing, but also understanding that when we can't process our emotions, we're so much more likely to have seeking behavior, because the seeking behavior comes from us wanting to seek out a solution to the dysregulation in our brain. In another experiment, this was Wiss et al. In 2020, they did an experiment with rodents. And what they did was they had this enriched an environment. So they had rodents run around and then they created an enriching environment. So like more space with more specific novel objects. And when there was more objects, more things to look at, more things to do, it actually reduced sugar-seeking behavior in the rodents. So what this really tells us from a research perspective is that this seeking behavior can be satisfied by things other than the substance, can be satisfied by things other than food. But because food is such a driving force and it's so immediately reinforcing, when I tell my clients, like, draw a picture, do adult coloring, go for a walk, it's hard for them to actually make those choices because the brain's already gone into mode of like, I want a hit of something, I want it now, I want it to be immediately reinforcing, and we're bypassing that prefrontal cortex, like, so we have more impulsivity, etc. Now, of course, in my practice, there's a way around this. Like, we're using hypnotherapy so that we can activate the prefrontal cortex so the prefrontal cortex can come in and choose the walk versus the sugar. Because at the end of the day, if eating is not the problem, if hunger is not the problem, eating is not the solution. And so we just need to teach the brain, okay, if stress is the problem, what's the viable solution for stress? Is it getting some fresh air? Is it having that difficult conversation? Is it holding a boundary with somebody? And when we can teach the brain to do that, the desire to seek any type of substance genuinely goes away. All right. The next thing that I had to prove in my research was that eating psychopathology is a treatment-resistant disorder. I mean, I don't think I have to go too far into this because I'm pretty sure if you struggle with any type of eating psychopathology, you know, like, there is no magic pill. Enter in the Mindful Method product 2024. Just joking. There's no magic pill. But obviously, nobody fucking wakes up and says, I want to be fat. That's like my tagline. I need to get a bumper sticker that says that. Nobody wakes up and chooses that. And so you can't look at somebody with obesity and just be like, oh, just eat an apple instead of McDonald's for breakfast. Like, okay, they're going to say, okay, it'll last 2 weeks and it won't continue. So overconsumption and most eating psychopathology is very treatment resistant. Like, there is not a single treatment that actually deals with this. I mean, now we have a lot more medications coming out, and it would be interesting to see how the research shifts from that perspective, looking at things like Ozempic and all of its other generic different brands. But to me, overeating, Ozempic might deal or might be a solution for obesity from just a weight perspective. But to me, Ozempic is not really a root cause solution, obviously, because it doesn't deal with why that person is engaging in overeating. And it certainly does not heal the overeating disorder, because the only reason why these people who are taking things like Ozempic are not overeating is because they genuinely feel nauseous. So it's like, it's not actually changing the brain at all. It's working on a completely different receptor. And one of those receptors is the GLP-1 receptor. So that's not like really in the brain, right? That's in the stomach and the various parts of how the nerves work with our organs, but we're not changing the brain at all here, guys, okay? So overeating is a treatment-resistant disorder. Eating disorders and eating psychopathology and addictions are often lifelong, and they have high rates of relapse. Also, eating disorders are among one of the most challenging mental disorders to treat. That was a quote from LaFrance et al. In 2017. And treatment for eating psychopathology has very low efficacy and high chance of relapse. So, like, what we're looking at here is we're really trying to identify the current solution that we have to this problem doesn't work. And so we need a new solution. Well, this is where psychedelics really come in. And this is probably the best part. So if you've made it this far, I applaud you. I know it's been a lot. I am very detailed and I really, really love this topic. So you can imagine my poor teacher, because I bored her to death. But enter psychedelics. Okay, psychedelics are unlike any other substance that we have. And good and bad. Good in the sense where, okay, we have this new tool. Bad in the sense where it's very, very, very difficult to actually research, regulate, and peer review in a very, or even identify, or, you know, research this in a clinical, empirical way to validate its efficacy, especially because it's going to have a different impact on every single person, which also is kind of why it works and kind of why SSRIs and anti-anxiolytics don't work. Like, yes, it's going to be different impacts for different people, but we're still affecting one neurotransmitter. We're still doing one specific thing. Psychedelics have an array of chemical reactions and molecular constituents that interact with the nervous system, not just the brain, but the whole nervous system, the neurotransmitters, how they're in balance with one another. It almost acts more like an adaptogen than it does like a something, lower something or raise something. Yeah? Okay. So a lot of the research that you're going to hear about now is done through ayahuasca. Ayahuasca and LSD are very similar, just they have a different like life lifelong. They have a different like lifespan. But ayahuasca is one of the oldest substances used because this is obviously used in indigenous culture. So when I'm like Albert Hofmann in 1938, like created LSD, like that is obviously not our first encounter with psychedelics. That's just the first like clinically researched and written about. But engaging in ayahuasca allowed for a different type of emotional regulation in multiple areas. So specifically related to self-sabotage and in binge and restrict cycles, as well as over-exercising and substance abuse. And so in this study, this was LaFrance in 2017 and his colleagues, but he did this study where obviously it had to be qualitative data. People were talking about their accounts, and this one individual comes up and they're talking about how all of a sudden they were able to emotionally regulate, which actually prevented a lot of self-sabotage, and not just self-sabotage and overeating behaviors, though that was prevalent, but also in their over-exercising, which I thought was so cool because that was such a huge part of my story, where over-exercising was so deeply correlated to my way of punishing myself for last night's dinner or my eating disorder. The other thing is, all psychedelics are very different from conventional experiences. So this is Rinelli and their colleagues in 2018. But psychedelics differ from the leading psychopathology or the leading psychopharmaceutical in the way that they were more effective, like when looking at this specific study. They allowed for a deeper healing. They allowed for the processing of intense emotions and or memories. And they provided lessons in discovery of love, self-care, and they provided a spiritual component to healing and recovery. Like, if that hasn't sold you, I don't know what else will. I have a client and she's had a very traumatic experience as a child, but cannot recall it. A lot of the time when we have these big, big traumas, we repress it. Like, people go their whole lives being like, why am I an alcoholic, or why can't I keep a relationship, or like, why do I keep overeating? And then all of a sudden when they start doing this work, like a memory will come back to them and they'll think they're crazy or that it didn't really happen, when in reality they've just repressed it. Their brain has repressed it to keep itself safe. And so when we're using specifically a macrodose in psychedelics, and that's what we're really trying to do at the retreat, it allows us to process these very deep emotions and intense emotions that are difficult to process in consciousness. Even if you remember the trauma, like I remember the kid had called me fat when I was 8. Damn him. It's even if I'm talking about it in talk therapy, even if I'm doing hypnotherapy, the brain might not be processing it, right? It might still create that active trigger. For example, when I was pregnant with Veda, Racer, who was 6 at the time, looked at me and he was like, "Mama, your stomach is so big." And I cried. I genuinely broke out in tears. I was so upset. And not only did I cry, but I actually held it against him. Like a 6-year-old who's just commenting on the fact that my stomach has gotten bigger because there's a baby inside. He said something and he was like, "Okay, I want mama to put me to sleep." And I was like, "No, you called me fat and you don't say that." Like, how fucking childish is that? I'm the parent and I'm literally holding it against my 6-year-old son for making an observation about my appearance. Like, that doesn't come from a healed person, folks. Okay, this was not that long ago. No matter how much I talk about this experience that I had as a kid and being bullied, there's a part of it that's still not fully processed, right? So if we want to go in and we want to process these really, really deep emotions, when I say process, I don't just mean remember. I mean actually process through the nervous system. Like, bring it up, fucking deal with it, get out on the other side. Yeah, so it's not still running the show. Psychedelics offer the opportunity to do that. The other thing here that's really profound is just the spiritual connection. And that's part of why it's really, really difficult to measure, because science doesn't love spirituality. Science does not love things that we cannot measure. And for a huge portion of my life, I was very academic based. And then I started to dabble into the spiritual world and it changed my life, and I can't fully explain it. But what I do know is that
so much of what we cannot measure is actually the thing that ends up changing our lives. And so I can give you vitamin B for fucking mental health, or I can give you vitamin D for to overcome seasonal depression. But at the end of the day, if we're not doing the spiritual work, if we're not connecting to this deeper part of our human existence and our the support of the energy around us in a very spiritual way, like, you're not really living, you're not really optimizing on all of the potential that there is for you. And I think that when it's probably one of the reasons why religion is so effective. I'm not going to even go down that road, but that's like why people have faith, right? So you just need to decide what you have faith in. In the next study by Spriggs and colleagues in 2020, the emotional release during the acute treatment, this is huge, right? So this emotional release, and this is one of the reasons why at the retreat we're using plant medicine. Like, yes, the main plant that we're using is psilocybin, but there are going to be other things associated and available to facilitate some of these. So like HAPA is one of them, or that allows for this more kind of release. And that release is going to facilitate a long-term emotional breakthrough. And that's what they learned in this study, where having this really, really cathartic kind of release of emotions released some trapped stuff that was running the show in the subconscious, because it was so deeply pushed down that even though the individual doesn't want to overeat, there's this like fire inside of them, or this buildup of emotions that eventually is going to motivate behavior despite not wanting to. So people who are engaging in things like LSD or ayahuasca or psilocybin are typically going to report powerful visions, right? Like, this is a hallucinogenic here. Like, we are not fucking around. Like, we are hallucinating. And they often have this like mystical or transcendental experience. And they may interpret these experiences as self-revelatory insights, which actually lead to the positive behavioral changes. And so what I'm trying to say here is, in this study, specifically in 2017, what they noticed, and this is where empirical data too just like can't be measured, is just like people are having these visions or having these hallucinations, and they're attaching meaning to what they're seeing. And that meaning is so deep and so profound and so spiritual that it they can't possibly self-sabotage. They wake up the next day and they're like, oh my God, I just had the most incredible, like, I believe in myself. I believe in life. And I cannot stress enough, another tagline of Jordana, your relationship to food is your relationship to life. If you do not believe that you deserve to be alive, if you do not believe that you deserve pleasure, if you do not believe that you like you have to earn your life, or that you deserve to be punished in any way, shape, or form, or that you're just inherently bad or you're guilty about something, your relationship to food will suffer. And so when we can facilitate these much deeper healing, we can actually change our relationship to ourselves. That's what we're trying to do here. Okay. The final thing that I'm going to say to you guys is we need to talk about limitations, right? And so, of course, there is a large population of people that cannot and should not engage in psychedelic therapy. So if you are schizophrenic, if you are on any type of SSRI or antipsychotic, if you are pregnant, if you are breastfeeding, if you have very high uncontrollable blood pressure, I'm reluctant to say that one because I don't fully, like, there's research on this, but I don't fully believe that it's the psychedelic drug that's increasing the blood pressure. I think it's increasing blood flow, which is exacerbating an issue with blood pressure. If your blood pressure is controlled, if you're on blood pressure medication, it's fine. But if it's uncontrolled, it's just better you do it in a clinical setting not at all. But the reality is, when it comes to the research for this, like I said, there is a massive lack of quantitative data because it is very hard to quantify somebody's spiritual experience. It's impossible. You can't, because you can't be in their body and you can't relate that to somebody else. And so it is difficult. Like, we need quantitative data, right, in order for the medical field to like fully accept and be able to like regulate and create specific doses for specific things. And I know we're getting better at this, but there's still a lot of gray area here. The other thing is, like, obviously there's a big restriction. So in some places we just can't use it. Like for my research, I couldn't hand out psilocybin. I couldn't hand out macro or microdoses. I had to interview people who had engaged in those things and also struggle with an overeating disorder. And so I'm going based off of their accounts, right? And despite the clinical interest in overeating in response to emotions, the investigation of emotions as a trigger for other behaviors like substance abuse, et cetera, there's been a lack of attention on things like binge eating. So there is, of course, like I just told you for a fucking hour, of the importance of childhood adversity and, you know, trauma and these things and how it impacts the nervous system. And then because the nervous system's impact, that child is more likely to self-soothe or won't be able to regulate themselves or has more impulsivity. But there's a lot of research done on addiction and emotions and not a lot on overconsumption of food and emotions. And so there's already just like a gap in research there. And then the final thing is current testing for things like binge eating disorder and food overconsumption is also very skewed. Like, how do we really quantify overeating? You know, is this something we're going off BMI? God, I hope not. Because, like, there are many, many people with hormonal disorders that do not overeat. And so it's like, or people who, for example, I'm at the top of my BMI. Like if I went to a doctor, they would be like, they wouldn't say I'm overweight or obese, but I'm like getting close to it. But my lowest weight is my best friend's highest weight. Like that's like put me in an institution. And so everybody's different. Everybody's built different. But when we're trying to quantify overeating and overconsumption, that is again, very subjective. So what my husband eats is very different from what I eat. If I ate like my husband, I would quantify that as overeating. But for him, that's pretty normal. So again, just like little gaps in research, little ways and places that hopefully the next generations, and I mean, even just like the next few decades of my life and my research can take like an area, it can point us in the right direction. And yeah, but ultimately, there are very few people that something like a psychedelic experience won't significantly benefit. So if you are still with me, if you made it this far, if you have any questions, I know this was a lot, please let me know. I've shared my thesis on my socials. I'm happy to share it again. It's a little bit dense, but people who have actually read it through have been pretty impressed. Oh my gosh, I forgot. I totally buried the lead. I forgot the most important part. In my specific research, the only outcome that I could prove with 100% certainty in a qualitative way is that every single person who is taking the psychedelic drug in a macro or a micro dose, every single participant had a reduced appetite. So this is an entire group of people who overconsume, and when they took the substance in a micro or a macro dose, it resulted in a reduced appetite. And so obviously this might be because it's working on the 2A receptor. This might be because it's helping to regulate emotions. This might be because, okay, now we're not stress eating as much, or we're more in tune with our hunger cues. Like there's just so many ways that we can take this. But at the end of the day, my research was very successful and also offers up more opportunity for more research in hopefully a more quantitative way in the future. But like I said, if you have questions, I'm an open book. I love talking about this. If you're interested in the retreat, it's going to be an incredible experience. I've literally rented out like the fucking dopest villa in Joshua Tree. And Joshua Tree is also really amazing for this type of thing because it has like 12 vortexes in it. So it's just a place that people go to take psychedelics and have a spiritual awakening. Like that's one thing that Joshua Tree is actually known for. So not only are we in the perfect place, but I also have another facilitator. She's a shaman. She's coming to help facilitate and she's incredible. And I will be facilitating and everything is all inclusive. And it's not just like, oh, we all get high and then like, see ya. It's an entire experience. So it's a 5-day all-inclusive retreat. We have a private chef. There's daily somatic movement. We're like actually releasing stored trauma from the body every single day. There's one-on-one sessions included. Like it's going to be incredible. So if you're interested, let me know. I think we have 4 spots left and that is at the end of May, beginning of June. If you liked this episode, don't forget to like and subscribe. And I'll see you back on another episode of the Head to Heal podcast. Bye.